Hey, this is Steve Benson. I'm founder and CEO of Badger Maps. I'm the host of the Outside Sales Talk podcast, and I'm the president of the Sales Hall of Fame. One thing that I really know well is what it takes to be successful in sales. And if you want to discover ways to transform your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, significantly increase your revenue, and create scalable sales systems for your teams, you should be listening to the Authentic Persuasion Show with my good friend, Jason Cutter.
Welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show, a place where business and thought leaders come to weigh in on important sales-related topics that you can use in your sales career and life. I'm your host, Jason Cutter. My mission is to get your help in changing sales from something prospects fear to an act of service they actually seek out and appreciate. Whether you're in sales, leading sales teams, or own a business, I hope this helps you improve your selling effectiveness and you can go out into the world as an authentic persuader. On this episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show, I have Steve Benson. So Steve is the founder and CEO of Badger Maps, which is the number one route planner for field salespeople. And this is going to be fun because this is one area I haven't spent a lot of time in, which is field sales. For Steve, after receiving his MBA from Stanford, he joined Google, where he became Google Enterprise's top sales executive globally in 2009. That's a pretty big achievement. In 2012, he founded Badger Maps to help field salespeople be more successful by optimizing their routes and schedules to save time and be on time so they could sell more. So as a vehicle and a tool to help them do what they do best. He also hosts the Outside Sales Talk podcast, where he interviews industry experts on their top sales tips. And he is also the president of the Sales Hall of Fame. Steve, welcome to the Authentic Persuasion Show.
Jason, thanks for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
And I am excited about you. Anyone that listens to this, I say the same thing every time. I'm excited for every guest, but I just love chatting about sales. I came to terms with that a while ago. I'm just a sales nerd and I just don't really care about it. And I've admitted that and I embrace it. And when I get a chance to talk to someone like yourself, who comes from a place of sales that I didn't experience, which is enterprise sales at a place like Google. And then you've then moved that into field sales, which is also something I haven't really experienced a lot. I think that's fascinating. And where I wanted to start is let's talk about the biggest challenge. And I'm going to use the word of the year, as much as I don't like it, which is pivot, where field salespeople may have had to pivot, which is the industry that you support, right? And we talked about this a little bit where they have pivoted, haven't, some things are the same, some things are different. Here we are later in the year, 7+ months after the pandemic started and became a reality. What are you seeing now within the industry of field sales?
Well, first of all, a lot of people assume that field sales isn't happening right now, and that's definitely not the case. We have about 5,000 customers at Badger Maps now, and they're all in field or outside sales. And about 20% of those customers have either gone out of business or changed their go-to-market model in some way where they no longer needed a routing or mapping solution from us. So the other 80%, things are still happening the way it was before. And I think a lot of that is because most businesses are essential in some way. We support all different types of field salespeople. So the ones that were, say, selling beer to bars or exercise equipment to gyms, they're the ones that really got hurt the fastest, I'd say. But if you're selling med devices to doctors or drugs to hospitals, or that's all essential. And so those companies have not gone away. Those jobs are still there. Those things are still happening. Maybe the companies aren't quite as profitable as they once were, but I think there has not been a major change there in field sales. And they haven't changed the way they've gone to market either. They haven't stopped meeting with their customers face-to-face. Face-to-face meetings are so important for a ton of different types of sales. It shortens sales cycles. It deepens relationships. And it's always been important. I think it's remaining important even in these crazy times.
And I think that's what's most fascinating too, is what you said about the ones that kind of disappeared and then the other ones, and then how important that is. And not just the, let's say, health standard government essential part, but how essential that is and how important it is and what they do. What are you seeing with the trend at all of field sales moving to inside sales, some that are shifting away from that or blending, doing some kind of hybrid?
I think it's always been blended for almost everyone. Like field salespeople also have desk work they do, right? It's not like they pretend the phone or that email doesn't exist, right? For the important interactions, they're meeting with their customers face-to-face to move the deal downfield, to demo something, sit down with them to build a relationship, that sort of thing. But of the 20% of customers that we lost, some were because it shifted their go-to-market model. Sometimes it was shifting to inside sales. Sometimes it's shifting to online sales. Kind of depends on the industry. For certain things, online sales would work or inside sales would work. And other things, it's just never going to be competitive. And it's something you could do for a short time, like in April of 2020, for example, when everything was truly shut down. But then as soon as things opened up again, they went back in the field. Because if they didn't, I think their competitors probably would, and they'd be at a disadvantage. But not to mention, it's just for complex sales where there's multiple decision makers, it's really hard to read the room and gauge what the customer's objections really are, what their questions really are if you're not in the room. It's hard to sell complex things over Zoom. It's easy to lose people, and it's just easy to have things drag on. There's a lot of reasons why we haven't seen that big of a shift. I'd say in terms of shifting from outside to inside, I mean, I think that was most people that, and I've got stats on this somewhere, but the vast majority were companies that were like, we had to shut down the sales team or we had to shut down the whole company, but we'll be back when things open up again. It's not like bars aren't going to want beer in the future. They're going to. We just have to shutter production, shutter the sales team, shutter everything until we're able to open back up. And so that was more the message that I got from our customers that were changing. It was less, oh, we're shifting to doing this in a different way.
Makes total sense. And like you said, some things are going to translate to telephone, virtual, online sales, and some it's just going to be difficult. I mean, I think anything is possible. It's just a question of what's that loss of sales revenue conversion going to be like when you try to do it without
the bigger transition. I think we've seen in these times is less office time. So people working out of their home offices. And that wasn't really a transition for a lot of outside sales teams because they already were working from their home office. Maybe they went into the home office, they'd fly in monthly or quarterly or whatever. But a lot of times, if you're selling stuff to all the dentists in America, a new dental tool or teeth whitening or aligning or whatever, if you're selling something like that and you need your sales reps to get in front of dentists, you probably don't have 30 offices spread across the country. You probably still only have a handful of offices and your sales reps just live in these geographies or territories. So they were already working remotely. But that's the big trend I think we've seen and change we've seen is that less likely the outside salespeople who are already not married to the office, but all the other departments, accounting, marketing, operations, et cetera, they're no longer married to the office. That's the bigger trend that we're seeing.
And what I'm seeing with my clients that I'm dealing with, when they're selling B2B, the biggest difference is now their customers are not in a centralized office, right? So everyone's now spread out. Everyone's working from home. So calling into the phone number that you would an office number, it may get routed to, let's say, somebody who's managing the switchboard who works from home that can't transfer it to somebody else who's working from home, right? So actually tracking them down or field sales mode, which is I would just stop by their office and talk to them. It's like, okay, now everyone's at home. How do I find that individual? How do I mail them something? Because I can't just mail it to the office because they're never going to get it.
Right.
And so we see that challenge a lot. And obviously that progression. Now let's talk about sales leadership, because I know this is one of the big things that you focus on and talk about and really want to help, which is sales leaders in a time like this, where I don't know where we're at in the scope of this economic crisis, right? I feel like maybe it's getting better. Maybe it's just a lull before the storm, who knows? But what are you seeing with that? Or what can leaders do? What are they are doing well? What are they not doing well?
Well, I think leaders, they face a bunch of new challenges in this kind of a bad economy, and they're doing something, probably some of them are doing some things well, some of them are doing other things badly. But I think that there are things that almost all businesses are facing right now that are new now than they were before. And we're facing them regardless of whether we're in just a short lull here and that will surge back strong, or if the disruption that we've had will cause a kind of a ripple effect throughout the economy for a longer period of time, and we may face a longer protracted recession or depression. Regardless, I think there are things that leaders can do, and particularly sales leaders can do, is kind of the area that I try to focus on. What can they do to make these times better? You have to react to the new landscape you're looking at. So the first major change, I think, is that your competitors may be behaving differently. They may be desperate. They may be aggressive. They may be willing to do things that they weren't willing to do before that you need to strategically react to. So your competitors may be discounting far more deeply than they used to, giving up a ton more margin. They may be liquidating their inventory because they're just looking to make ends meet. And so they're just flooding the market with a lower priced product, try to take market share and keep the boat floating, right, throughout this time. The competitors may be willing to give things away that they weren't willing to give away before, like free consulting, free deployment, other free things that they can just give away, throw into deals that erode margins. And really all of these things, it's all in an effort to keep their ship floating. And often it's at your expense as their competitors. So they're trying to steer customers away from you. Their actions are compressing your margins. Another thing that I think a lot of businesses are dealing with right now is their customers and their prospects are just behaving differently. So there's resistance to spending money. There's resistance to meeting you or entertaining new projects, new initiatives. If someone didn't want to meet with you before, now they have a fantastic excuse. Hey, we have no budget, or hey, I can't really meet with people right now. I'm really busy. Hey, we've got all kinds of things to do. But just a lot of times spending freezes have come from the top. And so it's hard to sell new initiatives, new ideas. I also think people are just generally running into margin challenges. The people who are purchasing things are procurement department or the buyers. Often there's been a message that's come to the organization. Hey, we got to go through all our list of vendors and just squeeze everyone wherever we can to get whatever money we can out of the system. So I think aggressive procurement departments really leveraging that down economy to get discounts from you, better terms, and generally do things that make your business less attractive, make your margins tighter. We can't be angry about this. We can be angry at our competitors, but really everyone's just doing what they have to do, right? The key is, how are we going to respond to all of these things?
And where's the focus going to go, right? So there's going to be a percentage of clients any business has that the one they're going to cut back, they're going to want to save money. And then from what I've seen internally, like for my company, and then also with my clients, is that there's also other clients. They have customers. I have customers that are doubling down. They see this as an opportunity. Now's a chance to do more, to build, to grow, to solidify. I mean, you and I were talking about it right before we hit record, which is clients that are seeing what you're doing and they've always done the same thing. Economy was great. It's really easy to be lazy with your technology, with your sales operations, with your processes, because it just works and it's making money. Tough economy comes, downturn comes. All of a sudden, you've got to actually do different things and change and grow so that you can make it through this. And so it's fascinating when you see both sides of the customer demographic, which is the people who are hunkering down and the people who are doubling down.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think a lot of that depends on what industry it is and what opportunities are out there and what your competitors look like. I mean, it is a great time to chew up and grab a bunch of market share if one of your competitors is stumbling. I mean, change always creates opportunities.
Yeah. And ultimately what it comes down to is the value you provide for the right clients who appreciate that, right? No matter what it is, the ones who want it. And it's valuable. Again, if you're the 16th CRM software that a company probably isn't going to use because they aren't using their other ones, or this tool, it's like, okay, we're not using the other ones and now is definitely not the time to try to buy anything new.
Yeah. And conversely, a lot of times people are willing to take a look at new things right now that they weren't willing to take a look at before. You know, now something that maybe was going to help, they thought, oh, that's a little bit useful, but it's low on the priority list right now. We've got all this other stuff going on. Maybe there's less stuff going on, A and B, maybe people are looking to scrape a few more nickels off the table. And so they're willing to take cost-saving initiatives or revenue-driving initiatives more seriously now, even if they didn't seem like that big of a deal before. Maybe now there's a little fire lit underneath them.
And I have seen companies where some sales people are just assuming that everyone is hunkering down because they've heard stories, or they themselves in their own personal life are hunkering down. Yet there's customers out there just looking for it, wanting it, needing it. It's about that perspective. So what do you see as the solution, or what kind of, I don't want to say advice because that sounds pretty strong, but early on you mentioned about companies who their competitors are slashing prices, giving away discounts, giving away free things. What do you do, or what would you do if that was your industry or market, your competitors were just blowing it out the door kind of mode, what would you do in that situation?
Well, I think with competitors, it's especially difficult, and it depends on what is going on exactly. Sometimes you're seeing someone in their death rattle portion of their existence, and so they're going to liquidate their inventory because they're taking the money off the table that is on the table, and there's not going to be a lot to do with it. I think you have to focus on the long-term relationships that you have with your customers. It's a great time to communicate to your customers. If you sell high-end glassware to restaurants and hotels, and your big competitor just seems to be unloading their warehouse at a low price, are you going to be able to not have them buy if it's kind of a replacement for your product and it's kind of commoditized? It's going to be challenging to not lose that business, at least while they go out of business and unload their inventory. But at the same time, by communicating and keeping the relationship good, you'll have them for the long term, right? So if you do have a competitor that's absolutely stumbling and doing unsustainable things. On the other hand, I mean, it could be that this is a great time to communicate the value better of your product versus a competitor. And so it really depends on what you're looking at. Sometimes if companies are under a ton of financial pressure, maybe they were choosing your product and now they're more interested in entertaining more of a commodity product that's lower quality, but also lower price. So that's an important time to be able to stay in front of those customers and communicate the value of why ultimately that cheaper product might be cost them more in the long run and might not be sustainable, might not be the best choice, because a lot of people are looking to change things up. So I think communicating with your customers, being in front of them, having the types of relationships that you can find out what's really going on is more important now than ever. I also think you can look internally to make changes in these times with respect to this. One thing that jumps off the table is if your margins are compressing because of things that your competitors are doing or just because of the market dynamic right now, people are negotiating harder, you know, the procurement department's charging hard at your sales reps, it can be a great time to make a change with the compensation policy that your sales reps have. So a lot of companies I see have their compensation policy based on revenue as opposed to profitability. And it's common with very high margin products. They're less worried about, they're more worried about the revenue, not the profit that comes off of an individual sale. Whereas in a, sure, in a more commoditized market, the comp plan is going to be based on profitability because it's, you know, and each individual deal has so much profit based on the price you sell it at, based on the number of units sold, et cetera. And so it's going to be based on that profit number. Now, if you are based on revenue, and let's just say you had 30% margins and now they compress to 15% margins, that is a great time to think about switching your plan to react to that, to being a profit margin based plan instead of a revenue based plan, because all of a sudden it takes two deals to make what you were making in one deal, right? The second you realign that plan, now that 15% discount that a rep was giving on a 30% margin, that was going to cost them 15% of their commission. But now on this new plan, it would cost them half their commission. So they're really much more aligned with the business and its goals if you make that switch. So if you, bottom line, if you see your margins compressing, review the comp plan and think about making the comp plan aligned with profit instead of revenue.
And of course, anytime you mess with comp plans, anybody's going to get upset, especially if you're changing it where it's going to be harder. And what I'll tell you, because I'm listening to you talk and I'm forecasting it as a sales leader, is that the people who know that they can win and they know how to win anyway will understand. And the ones that are in it for the company and the long term will understand it. If somebody in sales is fighting that and protesting it, doesn't want that change, then what that tells me is they only cared about their own compensation at the expense of the company and potentially the detriment of the company.
Right. And this should be a cost neutral move to the company. Like, I'm not saying pay your reps less. I'm saying reward the reps that are more in alignment with the company's needs. So the on-target earning, the total sum should be going out the door at the same price to the company, but the reps that are better at maintaining the margins will get paid better, and reps that are giving away a lot of the margin won't do as well.
And I think that's always important. I mean, and again, this kind of goes back to something I touched on earlier, which is when times are good, companies operate different, right? A lot of times they're kind of sloppy or they just assume things are going to be good. Like you said, they have their benchmarks. They know we're going to get a 30% margin. So we don't care about the margin because we just know we can get it and times are good. And then when it switches, that's when things get real. So speaking of cost reductions, one of the things I'm curious about your perspective is, now let's say you're within a business, and you kind of touched on it a minute, but you're in a business, you're a sales leader, you're running a sales or marketing team. Ownership comes down and says, you need to cut your budgets. I mean, still lots, still keep the company going, still generate revenue, maybe increase revenue. But by the way, you're going to do it with a lot less, you know, support and funds. Have you seen that? And then what is your recommendation in times like that?
Yeah, well, I think this is a super common conversation that's happening right now. And given that we've had great times the last decade, a lot of people maybe haven't had to deal with this sort of thing before, right? This is my career's third recession, so I feel like I've seen this before. But businesses are under a lot of pressure to reduce costs right now, right? Like, for a lot of companies, pushing revenue and driving more, gaining back what they've lost there is harder. And so a board, a CEO, they may look at the sales team as a high expense resource and a great place to reduce some costs. So if you're the leader of a team of this nature, it's common for you to receive that message, hey, lower the cost of your team by 20%. And by the way, keep the revenue where it is. If you are that person, if you are that sales leader, the first thing I'd recommend doing is, and this is because I come from the perspective that salespeople are the engine of revenue in an organization, I would make the point very clearly to that leadership team, hey, revenue is important to us right now. Sales should be one of the last places we're looking to cut at this point. And not to say if there's no weak links in your team that you shouldn't look carefully at cutting those, but it's important to note, hey, each one of these reps is bringing us 400 grand a year in top line. And when our margins are 25% and they cost 60 grand. So each one of them is profitable. We're going to gain their salary, but lose a greater amount in revenue and profit if we get rid of them. I would make that point first and do the math on that with how much revenue comes off of each rep, how much profit, and what they cost, and make that comparison. Then I would obviously look to, if the message that you get next is, yeah, great, still make cuts, obviously look at your lowest performers first that you probably would have ended up cutting eventually anyway. Look at newer reps that haven't scaled up or maybe aren't scaling the way you wanted them to, but work carefully from the bottom up. And remember that it is not a candidate's market anymore. It's a buyer's market, right? From a hiring perspective. We're coming off of historically low unemployment rates. And so it was really hard to get great sales talent. That's maybe not the case today. There's a lot of great reps out there that would love to work for your company, would love a shot. And so if you do have weak links on your team, it's not a bad time to replace them with someone stronger.
And that's a great point too, because in this market right now, again, towards the end of 2020, yeah, there's a lot of great salespeople and leaders on the market who, at no fault of their own, right? It's not like, oh, if you're so great, like, why are you available? It's the company shuttered, the company made decisions, the company did certain things. And there's some talent. I mean, like you said, supply and demand favors hiring right now.
Mm-hmm, absolutely. And one other thought on that I was just thinking about while you said that. If you're in a situation where you really have to cut costs, you don't always have to cut bodies from the team. You can also cut base salary. Well, I mean, salary, if you're any kind of leader, but specifically with sales, I would focus on the base salary and not cut the bonuses. Because if you give someone a base salary reduction, but leave the bonus in place, then, and obviously different industries, different companies have different situations where the bonus is worth a lot, whereas other companies it's worth a little. But especially if your bonus is worth a lot, if it's half your sales rep's pay, you can cut costs from your piece of the organization on the base side, but maybe not change what revenue is coming in all that much. Especially if it's clearly communicated, hey, this is a temporary thing. We've been told we had to make these cuts, and we don't want to, rather than firing people, making it so they can't pay their mortgages and lose their healthcare, instead we're going to reduce people's base salaries. But the bonus, which is the important part, is still in place. And that way you keep the incentive to keep selling as much as before, and no one loses their job. And hopefully this does kind of surge back and the economy comes back in a stronger way, that you can kind of get through the bumpy time and not have lost your great reps. And your great reps, you're less likely to lose just by compromising the base, not the bonus, because they are making more money on the bonus anyway. If you reduce the bonus, you're going to lose your best reps too, or you're going to lose your best reps. If you've reduced just the base, you're going to lose the people that cared about the base the most, who tend to be your worst reps.
Yep. The ones who show up for the base and are okay with the base and would like the bonus commission land, those are the ones that are always dangerous to a sales team. So let's shift a bit. Obviously, you're running Badger Maps now. You're dealing with lots of companies. You're also dealing with your internal teams, but you come from this lineage of selling and being a sales leader yourself, how would you describe your sales style or what made you successful in the sales side of your life and your career?
That's a good question. I think I would describe my sales style as relatively laid back, which is a weird message. I'd say I tend to not push as hard as some other people would push on things. I tend to try to answer questions and be as informative and consultative as possible. I try to not be too salesy in these moments, in these sales engagements, meaning I try to treat people as a friend who I'm consulting instead of a prospect that I'm really trying to push something on. And I think that comes across in the way you sell things, the strategies and tactics that you use during a sale. You're less likely to kind of lead people down a path real tightly. You're less likely to pitch and pitch, and you're more likely to focus on them, listen to them and their problems, and try to figure out how your solution and what would be really best for them. And that allows you to build the trust that you need to really ultimately makes the sale close better anyway. So that's always been my strategy, which is a little unique and a little weird, in line with a lot of what other people would do, but it's always worked for me.
Well, and what I would say is it's unique and weird relative to what classic salespeople should do and what we think people do or what we've been shown or seen. And that I would actually question what's actually successful long-term. Sure, you can do the pitch, push and tactics and stuff, but does that work long-term? Can you scale that? So obviously anyone who knows me knows that my sales style and how I feel about it is exactly that same way as you're talking about it. For you, what does it mean to be authentic?
For me, I think being authentic is related to what I just said about being consultative and being focused on your customer and what their needs are. I think to be authentic, A, you truly have to believe in your product. And I would advise anyone who doesn't believe that the product they're selling is creating value in their customers' lives and is a good deal for them, I would advise that that's going to be a tough product for you to sell. And in general, you want to be selling great things. You don't want to sell lemons, right? Meaning bad cars, not the actual fruit. But being authentic means that you believe in your product. It means that you understand your customer and how your product is going to help your customer or prospective customer. And being authentic means you can therefore communicate honestly about your product to them. And that can allow you to be more of a friend, more of a consultant, more of an asset to them than if you were coming at the sales relationship from more of a pushy perspective. Like, if I'm talking to a customer that my product's actually not going to help them, like, and it's a confusing world right now, right? There's a million tools out there and a lot of them say they do lots of things and there's a million products out there. If I'm talking to a customer and I figure out, oh, I know what they're looking for. They're looking for something like this. In my world, for example, we run into a lot of customers who are actually looking for something to build their territories on a map, right? Meaning if you had 100 sales reps across America, how do you break up their territories and how do you assign which customer to them? And people often think because of our marketing that that's what we do because we're territory management, right? But actually that's kind of a different problem. And I know who solves that. I'm going to point them to that person, that company to solve that problem rather than try to shoehorn our product, which can do that kind of, but really yeah. What we're focused on is when we say territory management, we mean the actual sales reps efficiency, right? Their route, their schedule, who to focus on, given that they're driving over to see this customer in this suburb already. It looks very similar from 10 feet away. Like if you were looking at someone's computer, at these two pieces of software, they look the same, but they're actually doing two different things. And so it would be inauthentic of me to kind of try to shoehorn my product in when there's a better one on the market for them. It's better for me to be like, okay, these guys do this and we do this. What is it that you wanted again? Let's talk about your problems. Okay. And then by being honest and clear and transparent, I think it all ends up coming back to you. Because if you push square pegs into round holes, those customers leave anyway. You don't create those valuable long-term relationships and you just waste everybody's time.
Totally agree. And I love how you put that, especially on the authentic piece. If we look at what you do for your sales process, what has made you successful, where does persuasion fit into that? Because I understand the consultative, you know, trying to understand it and wanting to help them. But then what about the persuasion piece? Where does that kick in for you?
Well,
I think persuasion and authenticity are also related. To be persuasive, it's important to be authentic, I think, because people pick up inauthenticity. They know not to trust you instinctually. I think people have great instincts in general. So authenticity is key to being persuasive. Being an expert in your field and an expert in your customer's field is really important to being persuasive. Mm-hmm. And behaving with integrity in such a way that your customers know that you're looking out for their best interests, or your prospects know that you're looking out for their best interests and not just kind of looking for the next transaction, is really important. So I think reputation and the way you communicate and the way you behave with your prospects and customers is really important to being persuasive. And ultimately, both emotions and facts can persuade. So you have to know all the facts, and then you have to have the emotional intelligence to connect with people and build that trust and build that relationship. And it's the combination of emotions and facts that are laid out in the right way that are truly persuasive.
And one part in there that I love that isn't touched on a lot, I mention it from time to time, but not enough, is to become an expert in your customer's field. And whether that's business to business and whatever their industry is, I spent a lot of time direct and business to consumer. And so it's understanding and being an expert in other people's lives and challenges and problems and their situations and what you're solving. That's huge, because then if you know what they're dealing with in their business, then you know if you can help it or not. And then when they say certain things, then that's your opportunity to put the square pegs in the square holes.
Absolutely.
So let's pivot one more time. What was it that you wanted to be when you were growing up?
I wanted to be a veterinarian for a little while because I liked animals. I'm a big fan of dogs, especially, always was. I actually did not start out wanting to run a business or a software company. No, even when I was in business school, I wasn't like training. I was kind of training for a corporate mid-management role, I feel like. I wasn't training to start a business. But then, you know, I ended up at Google and working with and learning about the Maps API a bunch, and then realizing I understood the field sales problems. And so I was like, oh, I could solve this problem on mobile devices with this API that field salespeople have. But yeah, I didn't start out wanting to do this. But I guess veterinarian, I would say.
Okay. In your line of stuff, what was the most non-sales job that you've had?
I've actually always been in sales. My first job was actually a brilliant entrepreneurial venture, of which I've never touched the margins of it again. But fireworks are illegal in Illinois. And so when I was about 12 or 13, I figured out that I could import fireworks by the mail. Like I could just like order fireworks to be mailed to me. And then I was selling them into my junior high school. So I was moving a ton of product in junior high.
That is awesome. Definitely sales, definitely logistics business.
I was soaking up everybody's lunch money.
That is awesome. Happy customers, I'm sure.
There was probably some legal risk there, but luckily no one blew their hand off. So it was the 80s. You could get away with different things in the 80s than you can now. 80s. Now I definitely would, I'd still be in jail, but.
The 80s, I don't know. I agree. 80s definitely felt like just a different time of options, but then also personal responsibility and what people just kind of understood and did. And you could play outside and it was okay to get dirty. Okay mm-hmm. to play tag, which now tag's illegal in some states. And so, yeah, it's just a different time. What would you define as your personal definition of success?
I guess when a lot of people say success, they mean financial success, but there's lots of elements of success. Like you'd be successful financially, successful from like a career satisfaction perspective. You could be successful from a relationship perspective, friendship perspective, parenting perspective. There's lots of places to be successful. For me, the definition of success is when someone A, knows what is the truly going to make them successful. Like they know what's important to them. Like, because there's probably 20 areas you could be successful in. You could be very successful in your hobby, like golf or something, right? Success means defining what success is for you, because I think it's different for everybody. And then actually taking the steps to be great at the areas that you define as being most important. I suspect most people screw this up on the defining piece. I guess people screw up on both pieces, but it's, I think a lot of people don't feel successful, and it's because they're chasing the wrong golden ring. It's always hard to actually be successful in grabbing golden rings too. So
true.
That is success for me. Doing both right.
There you go. And then last question, the journey or the destination?
Both. I think both are important. Okay. It's important to focus on a goal, and it's important to know what, you know, envision a destination and keep working towards that destination and know what direction the ship is sailing. But also, I think the journey is extremely important, and life's about the journey, right? I mean, we're all going to the same destination ultimately, so it's important to enjoy the journey.
Well, when you zoom out that far, then yes, definitely don't focus on the destination. That's not a good one. That's awesome. I love it. And I appreciate you sharing that. That's always fascinating. I love hearing what people say on that. So some places where people can find you and the stuff you're doing. I'm going to put a bunch of links in the show notes if people want to find it. So there's the Badger Map website, which is badgermapping.com. There's the Outside Sales Talk podcast, which is at outsidesalestalk.com. And I'm sure everywhere where podcasts are sold, you have your Sales Hall of Fame, which is on the badgermapping.com site. I know that you're super active on LinkedIn. Is that it? I think that covers.
Best place to find me. Yeah, for sure. LinkedIn. And the best place to find Badger is badgermapping.com. If any of your listeners want to try out Badger, just mention that you heard about me on this podcast and to the rep that you're talking to, and they'll give you 2 months free to mess around with the product. Make sure it fits all your needs. Make sure you get a chance to try it out and make sure that it helps you before you have to make any kind of commitments or purchase anything. It's $50 a month per rep. It's not a huge lift or anything, but it's worth checking out.
Give it a shot. And I appreciate that. And you never know how many Authentic Persuasion Show listeners out there are in the field rep or field rep management industry, which I think is fascinating. Steve, thanks again for the time and sharing and helping people in sales by being here. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Jason. I really appreciate you having me on the show. It's been fun.
All right. Take care.
Take care.
Thanks for tuning into the Authentic Persuasion Show. If you found value in this episode, please do two things. Subscribe so you can get each new episode and share this episode with anyone else you know in sales. Together, we can help shift the way sales is done. And if you want to find out more information about how to transform your sales career, or you want help with shifting your sales team from order takers to quota breakers, go to jasoncutter.com. Don't forget that everything in life is sales, and I will catch you on the next episode of the Authentic Persuasion Show.